you are.
Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, Akash Anand.
Hey, guys. Happy to be here.
The young, spry little pup, you know? How long you been doing comedy yet?
A year and a half now.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So you started, like, right when you were 18?
Yeah, right. As soon, like, a month after I turned 18.
And then you started at Rutgers right then, or no?
I started at Stress Factory, my first open mic.
And you were still in high school?
No, I just started college.
Uh-huh.
I just started college, yeah. I started because I always really loved comedy, like from a young age, because my dad loved Russell Peters, and then from Russell Peters, you go down the rabbit hole, I sound like Dave Chappelle, Louis, Chris Rock.
Uh-huh.
And so I always knew about those guys.
Keep going, I'm just going to check the audio level.
Okay, I always knew about those guys, and I always enjoyed it. I never knew I'd try it, though.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw before my 18th birthday, my mom took me to Dave Chappelle's Radio City run, one of the shows there. So it was like Dave, Hannibal Buress, Trevor Noah, Mo Ammer, Will Silvis. And yeah, it was just great. And I just saw what it was live. And I was like, I want to try this. So I just tried it as soon as I got to college.
And so you're going for supply chain management.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what in your head, as you work towards both these goals simultaneously, what's going on? Are they both struggling? Are you like, let me do this supply chain management. I can help some truck drivers get some ham to ShopRite, and then every night I'm going to be slinging my jokes, you know? Is that what the plan is right now?
Essentially. I don't really know. I was planning on actually taking a gap year after high school because I was sort of aimless. But because I was actually supposed to go to New York for school because NYU was my dream school.
Mm-hmm.
I was supposed to go to New York, but it was too expensive. I was like, I don't want to, because I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I was like, I don't want to sink an NYU degree without certainty as to what you get on the ROI, because it's a very expensive school and it costs a lot of money to live in New York. So I'm glad I came to Rutgers because they gave me some scholarship money, and I just was like, yeah, I'll just do supply chain management because that's what Tim Cook studied. And I was really into technology in high school, and I still am, really. I didn't really lose my passion for that as much as I thought I would, because after you pick up something like really artistic, like comedy, you're typically like not as interested in other things. But I've always been bad at school. I've never been really good at school.
So is Tim Cook the current Apple CEO?
He's the current Apple CEO. And I know he was a supply chain guy. So I was like, that seems interesting. It seems like a new field of study. So I was like, I'll just get into it. But I haven't even started my supply chain courses because I just finished my prereqs for business and declared my major.
So, That's a lot, you know. There's a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
You're a lot of moving parts. Me, you know. I didn't want to get into this right away, but you know, I took a photograph of you last week at the Stress Factory,
mm-hmm.
and I put it on Facebook, and mm-hmm. you decided to take your shirt off immediately when you walked on. What motivated you undressing for your set?
I don't know. I go through these huge anxiety attacks for like no reason, and whenever I have one of those, it's always like,
you were having a panic attack last
week before I had a panic attack like 6 months before that in my house, and I was like, next time I go on stage, I'm gonna take my shirt off. I don't know why that was my conclusion after the panic attack, but typically when you have like anxiety like that, it's like I gotta take some drastic measures. Like, I think anxiety expresses itself in different ways for different people. Like, for some reasons, for some people, like, anxiety is crippling. Like, they get anxiety and they can't make a decision. But when I get anxiety, I, like, immediately make, like, a drastic life decision.
Right.
So I'm like, I gotta do something.
You're trying to, like, snap your brain out of it.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, if you're paralyzed in place, like, if you like, stab yourself with a knife, you're gonna be able to move again because the pain resets your system.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always had this idea of trying to do sets without my shirt off, without my shirt on, just because I think I have a funny looking body and I want to try to take advantage of that. But also because I feel as though when you get into this rhythm of stand-up comedy and you're pursuing it and you're not really a feature act yet, you're not really even someone who's supposed to or deserves to get reliably paid consistently, it's very easy to get a rhythm of like, these are 5 or 6 jokes that I really enjoy doing that work consistently.
Oh my god.
And I'll do them for the next 4
can
years.
I name names for now 2 hours for the rest of the podcast people who are guilty of doing that?
Yeah.
Number one, not gonna happen on this podcast, but when my book comes out, I'm writing a book, by the way.
Oh, that's dope,
I name
man.
A lot of names. But anyway, yeah, I'm sorry. Continue.
Oh, yeah.
You had a sticker on your belly button. Am I mistaken about that?
Yeah, no. I was supposed to get a colored sticker, but instead I just had to print out. It was a picture of Steve Harvey.
Okay.
And I just covered my belly button with it. I don't know why. I just thought it'd be
Do you have a hairy belly button, or is it an outie? Are you?
No, it's an innie. There's nothing to block. There's no, yeah, I'm not ashamed of my belly button or anything. I just wanted to,
Now, when you had an anxiety attack, did you see Steve Harvey's face, like, spinning in the side, in the corners of your eyes, and you go, oh, okay, so I need to take my shirt off and put a Steve Harvey photograph on my belly button?
No, I was just thinking of, like, because I don't want to, you know what it was? It was because Bert Kreischer already takes his shirt off, and I was like, I got to do something other than just taking my shirt off, and I was like, you know, who has funny faces? At first I was like Mark Zuckerberg, because he's kind of a meme, but Steve Harvey's like a huge internet meme, so
Chompers, look at those teefers.
He looks so funny. Ooh, that mustache and those teeth, like, it doesn't make sense. His face is the way it is, and I just thought, if I want anyone's face on my belly button, it should be Steve Harvey.
I can't argue with that logic.
You know, it's great.
But I really respect you because I see you. I go to George Street Co-op. I dip in different places. I'm always bumping into you. I'm like, oh, fuck, this guy is really going for it. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's your passion, your enthusiasm.
Yeah, no, I love it a lot. I love comedy a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm probably not going to be doing anything much for the next 8 months. And then after that, I'm going to get back into it. Because Scott is getting deported soon. So he's leaving my house right now. We're just working on sketches every day.
Uh-huh.
And sketch writing is something I've discovered I'm really bad at.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I started stand-up, I was actually surprised that, like, it wasn't that hard for me to understand the basics of it. I don't even know where to start. Every time I write a sketch, it comes out terrible. And I film it, and it comes out terrible. And I want to work on these skills as well. Because I've always loved comedy in general. It's
right.
Not just, I love stand-ups the most.
But it's a good instinct, because you're going, like, not only do I have to be funny, I think I should be able to prove it on camera.
Mm-hmm,
and
no.
If I'm good,
no, yeah.
If I'm learning this skill of being doing stand-up in a club, and kind of reading the room and feeling that, and then telling my jokes, and you're getting good, like, pretty fast over only a year and a half in.
Oh.
I wish I was just doing, because I started just doing improv all the time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, if I was your age and just did stand-up, maybe I would have
been
further along.
But focuses you on the craft so much. Like, you can't really bullshit it as much. You know what I mean? Like, you can go to improv lessons, and I guess if you take it seriously, you can definitely improve your comedic skills. And I think improv is something as I've started exploring sketch and realized how bad I am, I respect it more. Because as stand-up, you always go, this is the hardest thing to do. This is the creme de la creme of comedy.
Right, right.
And you look down on other genres of comedy, and then you sort of discover that as you explore it, there are other skill sets in comedy that you don't possess, even though you're able to do this thing.
Mm.
And so I don't want to... I was also listening to Nate Bargatze talk about this, like, long-term stand-up careers. It's a lot harder to just pursue it with pure stand-up because you don't have any stability backing you. Like, if you can't really write, then you can't get a writing job, and suddenly you don't have the financial freedom to do certain things creatively. Like, that comes back to me taking my shirt off. It's like, it was really important to me to try new things. And I feel like a lot of the people who start at the beginning layer, they're like, oh, I don't want this booker to see me do poorly. Even people at Stress Factory, like, I don't want to let Derek see me bomb or whatever.
Right.
But I'm like, you know, that takes away from your long-term gains because you're unwilling to go into the unknown.
Right. So you're stuck doing your four fucking jokes for 15 years.
Yeah, no.
Okay, I'm going to name names. Number one, I'm not.
imagine just like everybody...
There's a couple people here, but a couple, you know, in different scenes, you go, oh, okay, you plateaued here, you know, like you're, you know, comfortable just doing this room on Monday, this room on Tuesday, this room on, and then you start going, okay, I'm going to do this joke, and then this joke, and then this joke, and, you know, I think your instinct is good, is like, even if you have to do something crazy, it's better than doing the same fucking shit every fucking week, you know?
Yeah. Also, like, you know what the weird thing is bombing is so terrifying when you're not in stand-up. You're like, dude, I can't imagine going up there and not
getting
laughs. But once you start doing it, you almost become acclimated to it in a weird way.
And also, there's some people, like Alex Nicholas, you know?
Yeah.
He never bombs. Right. Sometimes he doesn't get laughs, but sometimes he's so smooth where you're like, everyone was entertained, even though this didn't work or this didn't work. He's so smooth that... I don't know, man. I'm learning a lot watching from him.
No. Him and Gordon are so good at that.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I've ever seen... I have seen him bomb, but like not like a normal human. It's almost inhuman the way he refuses to bomb.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Gordon.
They both go down with fights, man. Like
no,
and like honestly, they mostly do well. So I'm just talking about the sometimes where they'll do a joke and it doesn't work, and then how they like K turn out of it. They don't turn and run. Right. They like smoothly slide out of it. Yeah, where you're like, oh, that wasn't even a bomb.
No, Alex has that great joke. I know this one of my sets where I go home with the radio off.
Yeah,
that's such a great joke. Yeah. It's such a meta joke. I can't believe people. I like it so much, but I can't. People like it as well.
I've done that 100 times where I'm going home going, I fucking suck.
Yeah, no, it's great.
I fucking suck.
That's where I am most times. Most times during the day, I was like, why am I not good?
Yeah.
I fucking suck. I want to stop. It's so weird. Yeah, yeah.
The people that have too much confidence, maybe people have a disadvantage if their parents, like, did a good job and, like, love them a lot and... Because then they go, oh, well, I did fine. It's like, no, you fucking didn't. Mm-hmm. No, you should go home if you bomb going, I fucking suck. If you don't have that ability to look at yourself that cruel, I don't think you're going to be that good. You're not going to push yourself to be better. Or like, hey, don't be boring next time you fucking talk with the microphone.
Right,
like,
right.
If they're like, oh, well, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Some people who, I don't know. Yeah, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's some people... Dude, I don't know what it is with you, but, like, sometimes I'll kill and people will come up to me afterwards and be like, that was a great set. And for some reason, my instinct is like, oh, they're just saying that. Like, they're just lying to me. I don't know if you ever, like I never...
Oh, like when I told
feels,
you?
This never feels... Oh, I never believe it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've never in my life... To this day, I still think this is, like, an illusion. Like, it's not real.
I think
that's
good. Like, I think we are living in a simulation. Maybe this is all a computer program, but...
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. Yeah, it's like if you allow yourself to start to think that you're good, you're going to immediately start to suck.
Right.
So you always have to think that you suck so that you strive to be good. If you ever arrive at the destination, you're there and then you're going to get comfortable immediately.
Uh-huh.
And then not work hard.
You know what? I think that's true for some people, but I've also seen people like blind confidence, I think, matters a lot in stand-up. I think blind confidence, if you have a work ethic, I think blind confidence without work ethic is bad.
Right, right.
But blind, like, because, do you know Rishi? Do you know Rishi Mathur?
No.
He's like this other, he's like a lot older than me, but he always walks on stage with like just the most confidence I've ever seen any human.
He's a North Jersey open mic guy?
He's like a New Jersey guy. He lives in New Hampshire now. It's weird. But yeah, he used to come here all the time like a year ago. But I've never seen him not have confidence. But he has a work ethic. Like, he never stops going up. He never...
Mm-hmm.
And I think that constant working on your craft is... As long as you have that element, whatever you need, whatever mentality you need to get there, it's, like, whatever mentality you want.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, man, I've seen... You know what's weird is people... You think people only plateau because you have all these stand-up stories of, oh, yeah, people get to the top of New Jersey or they get to the top of Wisconsin and they never move out.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people in New York just do the same jokes for, like, a couple years, and I'm like, dude, this is insane behavior. Because you're going up, like, 4 times a day.
Yeah.
How do you not have, like, 10 more minutes? You know what I mean? Yeah.
Like Mitch Patel. But, you know, yeah, there... And I also is, like, I think that it's disrespectful of the prime stage time if you stop working.
Right.
Because there's always, like, open micers chomping at the bit, you know, like a bunch of fish at the bottom of the pool trying to get, you know, get the food or get little scraps of stage time here and here. And if you get to the top and you're at the Cellar 3 times a fucking week, then you're headlining Gotham, then you're headlining Carolines, and then you're doing the same shit, you're just, like, enjoying the money you're getting, eventually that money's going to turn off, you know? Like, I think that's a bad strategy to screw over audiences like that, you know?
It's not me and my friend Scott, I'm coming back to, we've talked about that all the time, is you can plateau anywhere. You can plateau once you're a headliner.
Oh, yeah.
You can plateau, like, once you get to the Cellar. And we heard podcasts of, like, Kevin Hart talking about this. It's like, as soon as you get to the Cellar, people are like, yeah, this is where real comedy is. And people who have, like, just, they just stop growing because they're like, I'm a top-tier comic. Even if that's true, you got to keep...
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, the Cellar is this legendary place. The Comedy Store in the West is also this legendary place. But it's very easy to go to that place and be like, I'm the best. What else do I need to do? And
right.
I think that's where the death of whatever your act was begins.
Well, there's this thing where, like, now it's a job. Now you're making money. Mm-hmm. So then there's two things. There's the fear of bombing, right?
Right.
Which keeps you to what's safe is your old jokes, your old act. But
it's also reputation, because now you have a reputation as a Cellar comic.
Right, right.
You're like an S-tier. You're like Kings of New York at that point, right? Because you go to the Cellar, you kill, you know, some girl wants to like have sex with you later. You're like, why would I give this up?
Right, right.
Like, Chris D'Elia talked about it. And it's like, oh, yeah, people who do comedy for pussy for, like, 16 years. And that's, like, where they stay.
Right, right. Because
they're not willing to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, man, that strikes a lot of fear in me. But I think also another part is that is, like, financial security. It's a lot easier to take creative risk when you have money in the bank and be like, okay, I can bomb here.
Right.
I can lose everything. That's why I think writing gigs or some other income stream other than stand-up helps your stand-up so much.
Yeah. Well, I think improv helped my stand-up, like, coming from that base. Like, I did improv only for 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
I did stand-up, like, you know, for 1 year.
When That's so interesting because you seem like such a stand-up when you go on stage.
Well,
like,
now,
the way you talk and stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, I started with stand-up when I was, like, 16. Then when I was 17, I just started doing improv until 26.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was 26, I go, wait a minute, I just did this for almost a decade, improv. If I'm not hired on a sitcom as an actor, I'm going to be a loser my whole life. Like, there's no way to make fucking money. I don't. If I'm a painter, I need paintings to sell to get money to buy sandwiches and have rent, right?
Right.
So I'm like, I need to eventually have a stand-up album so I can sell it and then get sandwiches and rent money, right?
Right.
So then I was like, okay, I'm just going to do stand-up now. Mm-hmm. And then at that age, I switched and just only did stand-up from then on. So, but I think the skills of improv, like, dealing with, like, having no script and just relying on your scene partners to kind of build something, you can turn that into audience members from Ohio who are a construction worker. Then you kind of go, oh, if this is true, then what? If this is true, then what? And even when I'm at home writing, I'll think of a joke and, you know, and then go, okay, if this is true, then what? How much can I, how further can I push this premise? Or how can I take this situation and have analogous other situations where this stamps onto it like a morality play?
No, I get it.
So there's a, like, it helped my writing, it helped my stage fright, it helped a lot, but I mean, it took a long time as a stand-up to have my improv skills percolate. Because at first I would be like, I'm on script, I have these five jokes, I'm going to do this, number one, number two, number three. And if I missed a word, I would get, like, tripped out.
Right.
But now I feel like I'm getting to that part where I can, like, blend. I can try to learn from Alex Nicholas how to smoothly go from one part to another and have everything look like just a conversation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's starting to come together for me. I definitely have some bits where I know, like, if I say this, this will work, you know?
I've noticed with you is, like, even when you're not doing a punchline, it's just interesting to see you talk.
Oh, thanks,
man. You have a very interesting stage demeanor, like, I don't think you speak the exact same way when you go off stage, but when you're on stage, you have, like, this cadence.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's very, like, calmly authoritative. Like, it's like, well, you know, like, you say that, I like stand-ups who say you know well, because a lot of people say you know, like, terribly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know is a very easy tag for a punchline.
Yeah, it's something I try not to say it.
The way you do it is interesting to hear. Mm-hmm. I like hearing it, you know what I mean? So that's always been something I've admired. I always have admirations for stand-ups that have, like a natural stage presence,
because
I'm always very written. I'm always like, these
well,
are my
it's
jokes.
Not really natural when you think about what I've said. My experience was, it's like very learned. I like
okay.
really
so it's like
worked on
years
it.
Over years.
Oh
years
my
years.
God! And then your experience kind of comes up where it's like, you know, I bombed and I've cried in New Orleans. Like I remember bombing.
Where did you start? You started in New Orleans, or
no? I started in Los Angeles when I was 26. I was in Los Angeles.
Oh, that's
I think
crazy.
2013 or 2012, something like that, where I was just like doing straight stand up from
gotcha.
Now on. But I started in 2002 with stand up, but only for like, you know, maybe I did a dozen times or 15, 20 times, and then I saw a show at the Upright Citizens Brigade, and then I started taking classes there, and then would start just to improv. So Los Angeles, I started, but. You know, I was just doing the open mic circuits. You know, I started with people like, you know, Frank Castillo and Jay Light and people like this. And then later on I see them do roast battle, like explode with that, you know. So I've seen like certain friends, it was Quincy Jones, you know, he did like 1,000 sets in a year twice. And I would go around with him, you know. And then I moved to New Orleans, and then what's cool about New Orleans is, like, it was a more obscure town.
Mm-hmm.
So when I felt comfortable in a room, I didn't feel like someone was going to steal it. I kind of had that sense, because as an open micer, like, you can get stolen from by, like, Family Guy or by, you know, whoever, you know? Carlos Mencia, but there's other versions of Carlos Mencia. Like Family Guy, the writers would go in the back of the Comedy Store and fucking steal, you know? So that was terrifying to me. So it was great to be in New Orleans to develop so that as I was working on some of my favorite bits now that, you know, I could work on them without fear of that it would be taken from me. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, it's great to be, to develop in a place like North Jersey or a place like Columbus, Ohio, or a place like New Orleans or Nashville. Mm-hmm. Like, get good somewhere away from New York and LA.
Right.
Get really good, film yourself, and then gift yourself into a prime city like that with a special done that you self-produce. But I think you should give yourself 10 years before you fucking film that shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Because then it's you know, there's no taking it back. Got if it. It sucks. So that's what I would say. But yeah, man, it's not fucking easy. It's not like being an engineer and now you're working on the, you know, United States Corps of Engineers, building bridges and making, you know, $75,000 out of school. It's not like that. It's like, I went to New Orleans. I got my master in screenwriting from the University of New Orleans, at, you know, doing stand-up every night for 3 years. So cross-training like that, for school, I had to do screenwriting, and at night I was doing stand-up with black people and smoking weed. Mm-hmm. And I think those two skills, like you're saying, writing, plus that made me a way better stand-up, was gotcha. Really focusing on screenwriting.
No, I get it, yeah.
So, because then you go, you know, it's just about information release. And you were talking about my cadence, you know. For me, it's all about information release. If this is the setup, I want everybody to know what the setup is as clear as possible. Punchline, punchline, punchline. You know, you, like, make sure that even the people in the back are on board with you. Mm-hmm. And then, because I don't want to waste this punchline.
Gotcha.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like you got to really slow him down, like hypnotize him. Like L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah.
You know, before you tell him about Xenu, you got to get their cuckoo brains on the same fucking wavelength as you
little,
before you...
the little machines that you hold. that South Park episode was so great.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I think you're right, man. I think it takes 10 years. But also, yeah, I think it takes 10 years. I don't know what it is about 10 years specifically, though, but I think every special that I really enjoyed, the stand-up was, like, precisely, like, 10 or 11 years in.
Yeah, because, like, then it starts to be a law of diminishing returns. Like, if you're 10 years in mm-hmm. and, like, nothing's happened for you, you're gonna do this bitter turn. Mm-hmm. It's gonna be like, oh, well, where's mine? Mm-hmm. You know, when's it gonna happen for me? Mm-hmm. I've seen this person make it. Where's fucking mine?
No, yeah.
And then if you get a flavor of that, mm-hmm. I mean, you're gone because now your focus is away from, let me shoot a special, let me never do those jokes ever again, and now let me work on a new special. Mm-hmm. And if you know, Mitch Fatale, if you keep doing your old special jokes in the Comedy Cellar on a Saturday, you know, in 2019, man, it's not going to take long for people to figure out that you don't write, you know? Yeah. Like, you have to.
No, it's so difficult. Yeah, so it's so easy to get in complacency.
Yeah, but it's like, it's a crap, it's, I don't like, I also don't like it being considered a skill, because if you think stand-up's a skill, I don't think you're writing, like, it's a craft. It's like,
what's the difference between the
two? I don't know. It's like, let's say you're like, oh, I'm a cabinet maker. I got skill. Let me just eyeball this. It's like, no, no, no. Take the measurements. Take the measurements. It's a craft. It's not a skill. You can't just, like, take a bunch of wood and go zat, zat, and start cutting it. No, no, no. Every time you do it, you should have a blueprint. And go, okay, this is where the microwave's gonna go. This is where the pots and pans and a lazy Susan are gonna go. Work on it. Mm-hmm. Don't go, oh, this is a skill, so let me just do this off the dome. You know, then I think you start getting complacent if you're, you know.
Yeah, there is, I think, such a thing as being, like, too good at crowd work or too good
at, like, because then you're not writing.
The ancillary skills. Yeah, I mean, the act is the act, right? Like, the act is ultimately what goes in the special. The act is ultimately what gets you.
It's a list of jokes.
Right.
Then when you film the list of jokes, that's gone. Now you got to start over. Right. And so it is a skill of being funny, but it's also a craft of preparing, mm-hmm. you know? I also see some people, like, get off on the attention mm-hmm. Instead of... you're there to entertain the audience. You're not there for the audience to watch you.
Gotcha.
That's a huge difference. And I see sometimes, you know, like, you talk about those golden knights of the cellar, you know, the kings of New York that get that stage time all the time and get paid well for it. You know, you gotta, once you're knighted, man, it's like, okay, now what? Are you going to be lazy and enjoy your money and start to relax? Or are you going to double down and write more, you know?
Yeah, that's a huge, yeah. I think that's why I like Ali Wong so much, because Ali Wong took 10 years and then released Baby Cobra. Mm-hmm. And then, like, 2 years later, she had Hard Knock Life. And then she's on tour again now.
Yeah.
So I don't think she ever gets complacent with success. But I don't think it's really success that makes you complacent. I think, like, if you're the type of stand-up comedian where as soon as you get some money, you're like, okay, I want to stop, it's probably because you never really loved it as much as you thought you did, or it was always an outlet for you to get started. But I have that thing, too. It's like, it's not completely honest of me to be like, oh, yeah, I'm just in it for the love of comedy. You know what I mean? Because I see people who, like, have more stuff than me and stuff, or have, you know, fame and wealth, and I'm like, I kind of want that. I would be lying to myself if I said I didn't.
Well, you
want to
be comfortable, and you want to have a nice office to write your jokes. You want to have a little bedroom. You want to have a hot wife from the Ukraine and a little massage room and a meditation studio with gongs. You know, that's all good. But at the end of the day, you should still go to that writer's room and fucking work, you know?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a huge part of the Also, the thing with writing is it's I think people, honestly, Mark Zuckerberg has a good quote on this, is that people, as soon as they get successful, they get biased towards inaction. It's like, oh, the next thing I have to write has to be perfect, or the next thing I make has to be as good as the thing I already made, right? But I think if you just start doing it, and you just start hammering away, even if it's not as good as when you were hammering before, eventually you'll get to an even higher place than before.
Well, you can't be afraid of bombing. You can't be afraid of doing new material, you know? And so,
It's not even, like, new material, because, like, you think, oh, because after you do a special, you're like, oh, I have all these jokes that I know are perfect. They're essentially structured perfectly that you've accumulated over years and years. The next jokes that you try on stage will not be as perfect. And even the ones that kill are not going to kill as well. And you're going to have to be comfortable with that and knowing that. It's like that thing Louis C.K. described where it's like making a sword, because you fold it over and then you hammer it again and you fold it over and then hammer it again. So I think a bias towards action, just get out and do it. Just get out and do something and just get your muscles flowing. And I discovered the same thing with writing as well. It's like, you go through the entire day, it's like, I have nothing good to write. But when you get in front of your community, you just start writing, eventually something might come up. So I think that's
it's interesting. I'm going through this process now where, you know, I shot a special in September. You know, I did a whole tour. Me and a camera guy drove across the country in this car. I folded the back seats down, and we had our equipment and, you know, a giant cooler of sandwiches and iced tea and stuff like that. And we drove across the country. Now, I'm interested because I have a screenplay of all the jokes in order, you know, one, two, three, this jokes. And, but I know, like, for time, or maybe we didn't get a version that worked as well, I want to know what jokes aren't making it in the special so that I know, okay, maybe I have, like, 6 minutes that were on the cutting room floor where after my special comes out, I have six instead of zero. You know what I mean? So it's this weird thing where it's like, okay, what made it into the film? What was filmed and what wasn't filmed? And how do I start over with the leftovers that fell on the editing room floor, you know? So, yeah, it's interesting. I'm excited, man. It took me, like, you know, my whole fucking adult life to, you know, and all the relationships that I fell apart because, you know, also in New Orleans, I would tell girls, like, when I had two girlfriends, like, one for 8 months, one for, like, 4 months, but I told them, like, both up front, like, okay, here's how my life goes. It goes comedy, it goes going to class, doing my homework, making money for rent and all that stuff. Then it's you. Like, I got you're in fifth place or whatever. That sounds bad. There's no other girls, right? But it's like, that's, I can see, like, once a week or so for this and that. And they were like, yeah. Once they realized how high I prioritize comedy, they were like, all right, but, you know, I need more attention than that.
Dude,
so
it's so
later.
Fucking crazy. That's what the thing that frustrates me so much about Rutgers is that it's not just with comedy. It's like, even before this, I started my own business in high school, and I was really into that. It's really, when you're a person who, like, is really driven to do something, it's hard to be around people who don't have that anchor in their life.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, my God.
It's hard to be a people who aren't, like, passionate about their careers. Like, not even comedy. It doesn't even have to be anything artistic. Just have something in your life that you, like, want to, like, go for. Like, I was texting this girl recently, and she was, I don't know if I should.
Yeah, you should. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, what do you do, right? I was like, what do you, like, do? And then she was like, oh, yeah, I do art, right? And then I was like, oh, what else do you like doing, right? And she was like, oh, yeah, Netflix or whatever.
Mm.
To most people, like, Netflix or whatever is, like, number one thing.
Oh, sure.
Like, they go to school to get a job or whatever, but their life's purpose is to, like, go home and, like, be consumers. And I don't know why I phrase it like a fucking hipster or whatever, but, like, most people never don't have an anchor in their life that they really care, like, deeply about.
Right, right. No, just talking about my thing at the time when I was in grad school, it was comedy, it was this, it was going to class, it was this. If, like, number one is Netflix, number two is going to the bank where you work.
Right.
Number three is going to be Netflix as well, and number four is going to be their car. It's like, this person, you know, they don't have... You know, it's going to be hard to date someone like that that's not like, oh, you know what? I wake up, I compose music from day and night, you know? Uh-huh. Or like that person, maybe they're in balance, but I would be way more attracted to that person, you know?
No, yeah. Dude, those people are the only people who are like worth anything. Yeah, you know what I mean? I've discovered like being myself for so many years that it's actually like 100 or 120 people determine the course of every generation, and then everyone else just follows
suit. Followers, yeah.
Yeah, follows suit. Yeah. Not necessarily in a bad way, like everyone that's has their individuality, but like what is going to happen in the next 50 years is determined by like
two. Yeah, because the outliers move the zeitgeist
by huge margins. Yeah, right.
And that's why comedy is so important, right? Because they're the ones. I was thinking about this the other day. Hillary Clinton will never, ever, ever, ever be president. You know why?
Why?
Because Chris Rock said, that's a first lady. She's a first lady that should be sucking that dick. If Monica comes in, why don't you tickle the balls or something? I got the dick. I got the dick. Because she couldn't suck her husband's dick. And he started looking around. That's her first job. You know how many black women in the ghetto, when Bill Clinton came out, playing that saxophone, their genitals were fucking exploding. And they're going, bitch, why don't you get on your knees in that pantsuit and suck that dick before I do? You know what I'm saying? She will never, ever, ever be president. No matter how much she worships Moloch, no matter how much, you know, ritual magic she does in the Golden Dawn or whatever the fuck, she will not ever be president. No matter how much the CIA wants her to be president because she's a dirty bitch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much the bankers want her to be president, no matter how much CNN wants her to be president, it will never happen because of the strength of Chris Rock.
You think Chris Rock?
Yes.
Think just Chris Rock, no one else?
Those that special, that bit, that ended her presidential run forever, I believe.
I think there's another bit that's more influential from Chris Rock. It's about Michelle Obama, a black wife. I think that bit is very, because that after I heard that bit, I could never see the Obamas in a different light. It was always like, there's some dynamic there.
I know, isn't that powerful? How he put like Chris Rock is such a powerful performer. He puts voodoo on people.
Yeah,
man.
He does. He puts.
He tattoos their personas forever with his material.
Right.
That's power, man. And when you're saying the 120 people move the zeitgeist, everyone else follows, I think comics are like 98 of those 120, man.
I don't think so.
I think people's Netflix is number one. They're watching, what do you think they're watching?
Comedy. But I think I think comedians who take themselves too seriously, like, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, I'm so important.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they always, because comedy is not conducive to that.
Okay, but you know, Jim Norton really taught me a lot because he taught me that when he talks about himself awfully, when he has this bit about how one day he was so depressed he was like taping a dildo between his tits before he was going to shoot himself in the fucking head. And like when he admits to that level of darkness, then it gives him license to say anything about anyone.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's that weird, like, karma, where it's like, I hate myself so much, I'll be honest with you about how much of a piece of shit I am, so when I say something about somebody else, I'm being honest with you. And he, like, buys that credibility with the audience, and it's really interesting.
I want to go back to the piece you're talking about, comedy is important. So what do you think about, like, Jon Stewart or something like that, or some political shows?
Yeah.
Because they have very real political influence.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember in the, you know, 2000s watching Jon Stewart, like 2007, and they would say, like, most people have said that they get their news from political talk shows like The Daily Show and Saturday Night Live Weekend Update. And we say, stop doing that. And then they would have the show, but then they would talk about real issues. And they would really smash people for corruption. They would smash people for this and that. Mm-hmm. And, I think...
That has to be such a weird paradox, though. Because you're a comedian first, no matter what.
Yeah.
Your first instinct is always going to be for comedy. I think as soon as people see you as a philosopher or someone important,
yeah,
you lose your artistic license a little bit.
Kinda. But it just depends how many fart and dick jokes you sandwich into the political stuff. Like, you know, George Carlin and Bill Hicks would talk politics, and maybe Bill Hicks would do too much, and maybe Carlin would, you know, I don't know.
That's so different, because they were pure stand-ups. They never did TV and stuff. But I think as soon as you get into the system of Hollywood... I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing.
If they ask your opinion, you're saying, like, if you become a successful comic, mm-hmm. and then, like, Jon Stewart, you go on a news show, or you go on, and then they're asking you about Iraq, like you know anything about
right.
that.
Right, no, but they don't entirely run away from it, because I guess in a weird way they know they're well-equipped to occupy that position, but they shouldn't at the same time.
Well, do you know Jimmy Dore?
I don't.
He has a show where he is a comic, but he goes after, you know, the warmongers in the political system. And mm-hmm. I think he's pretty fair. I think he's good at deprogramming the CIA talking points of CNN, you know?
But do you see what I'm saying? Is that he has to be fair now, because now you have that expectation of him. It's like, oh, yeah, he's a fair guy. And I listen to him because he's fair. Right. What if he was like, I want to be unfair in order to be funny? Because that's where the funniest thing is.
Well, I think he's careful to write things. Okay, so there's a book called Truth in Comedy. It was written by Del Close. He, like, was the founder of improv. And he was basically saying that what's true is what's funny. You know, and if you expose a truth that people don't think about. Like, even Chris Rock says, you know, they don't get... the government doesn't get paid for the cure. They get paid for the treatment, you know?
Right. Yeah, no.
Like, Chris Rock has these big bits about the pharmaceutical industrial complex.
Brilliant. I think it's my mom's favorite bit, too.
He's coming in on a conspiracy that's real.
Right.
That he's exposing the truth of. And I think Jimmy Dore is in that same way when he exposes warmongers who wants to go to Iraq and makes fun of them. And he punches them in the face with his jokes, and he makes sure that the evil people are the punchline. Then I think you're on. Then I think you're doing informing and being funny,
right?
You know.
But I think as soon as you start informing people of things, you it's like a Pandora's box. You know what I mean?
Well, it's just information. You know, like every setup of a comic is information.
Right.
Oh, we all know this, and this is true.
Right.
So now here are my punchlines. And if you're talking about real shit that has consequences, it might be.
I think the realest shit is the funniest shit, though. Yeah. I think I've had this conversation before. Is I think most, not all the time, most of the time, the funniest bits comes from some deep-rooted truth.
Yeah.
That you expose, like you just mentioned.
Yeah.
But I think, like Louis C.K. had this famous interview. I don't know if you've seen this, Donald Rumsfeld.
And welcome, Donald Rumsfeld, to the Opie and Anthony Show,
sir.
Yes, indeed. How are you?
Very good. Welcome to the show, Mr. Rumsfeld.
Have you ever been interviewed where you got upset with how it went and then actually did anything to exact revenge on the person?
Never.
Why would he do that, Louis?
I don't know.
That's Louis C.K.
Because you know, if you're a man of power, it's got to be an interesting thought, at least.
Got to expect people to come at you, because in our wonderful country, everyone can have their own opinion. They can have intense opinions.
It's interesting, though, because there are people who think, I mean, here's a guy who met Eisenhower as a congressman and, you know, worked for Ford and Nixon and Reagan and both Bushes. And there's still those people out there that think, you know, Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney are actually lizards who, I mean, literally, there's people that think they're lizards from outer space.
Yeah, that's true.
Who eat human flesh. I don't know if anybody's ever asked you directly, sir, but are you a lizard?
I don't think he's a lizard.
Can you just please give that a straight answer? Let him answer. Are you a lizard?
Here's the short answer. Yeah. I'm in New York City. I walk down the street. People walk up, shake hands, stop me. They want an autograph.
He's a lizard.
Want to get a photograph with me. Go to eat last night at dinner, and Joyce and I were sitting there in the little Italian restaurant. and a man came up and said he'd like to buy my dinner.
He's
and I
yeah. You didn't answer the question.
He's that not going to dignify.
I think you're hanging around with the wrong people.
He's not going to dignify an answer to, are you a lizard, Louis?
Why not?
He's not a lizard.
What is his story about getting somebody paid for your dinner? I would pay
because
for a lizard's dinner.
I think I understood the fact that there are people out there that appreciate what he's done
as
a leader. And
there is plenty of evidence that this guy is a well-decorated and appreciated American. And he has more credibility than almost anybody.
Exactly.
But I just want to know if he's a lizard.
He's not a lizard.
Yeah, you asked him if he was a lizard person.
Uh-huh. Wasn't that amazing, though?
That was great.
But that's almost like that's like the most comedian thing to do. Because he's talking about, you know, Donald Rumsfeld is a warmonger. He's done all those things. But he's doing it in a way that's so
surreal.
Comedy intensive.
But also, you know, David Icke is out there. He's a hardcore conspiracy guy saying that Donald Rumsfeld is a lizard person. Mm-hmm. That's why he's a warmonger. That's why he rose to the level of power, because he has lizard blood.
But do you still think the royal family were shape-shifting lizards?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes.
And you also want us to believe 9/11 is a conspiracy?
Yes, but the
doesn't
point
that rather undermine? I mean,
well, no,
I
doesn't.
Can see the point that you might have some question 9/11, but if you also think that Buckingham Palace is inhabited by lizards, it kind of undermines.
But it's not that simple. There's a whole big backstory before you get to what I'm saying. If you deliver it in one line, oh, you know, the world's run by reptiles, you meet it on one level. Oh, that's crazy, immediate reflex action. But when you see the backstory and the evidence to support this, ancient and modern, you see that one line, throwaway line, in a completely different context.
That's what David Icke says in multiple books, you know? And so it's kind of funny where Louis is like not talking about any of the real crimes that Rumsfeld did, just the most ludicrous one.
But it's so weird. He won't answer it. He won't answer it. And whether or not it's a lizard person is irrelevant to the fact that he won't answer the question.
Yeah.
And it's so funny.
Yeah.
And it's so like,
but
oh,
then
yeah.
It's like, oh, wait, maybe he is a lizard person.
Yeah, I read that. I was like, he's definitely a lizard.
Because if he wasn't, like, ask me.
Are you a lizard?
No.
Yeah.
Right? He
yeah.
doesn't say that, right? Yeah. That's an easy question to answer.
Yeah.
But maybe I think Rumsfeld's met some, at least.
Yeah,
maybe he's not one, but he, like, you know, goes down to the CIA in the basement. They lead him to an underground tunnel. He takes a train, you know, under Mount Shasta, you know? And then he, like, blows, like, 5 aliens and then comes back and is, like, gives a full report to the president.
I'd
you
be
know?
So happy, though, if we were ruled by aliens. That would really make me happy if I found that out. Because I'd be like, oh, it's cool now. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, whenever I look at...
I guess as a scapegoat to be like, our incompetence is justified.
Well, whenever I look at how an insurance company works, like, you know, if you're a veteran, a war veteran, and you apply for...
Are you a war veteran?
No. If you apply for medical benefits, they're like, cool, you have PTSD. Fill out these 83 pages. Okay, you have PTSD. How are you going to fucking fill out those 83 pages?
I can't fill out one
So
page.
It's like a war of attrition. They try to, they make it so hard for you to collect the medical benefits that you have earned by being a war veteran and killing people for the Illuminati. So then you do all that stuff for the lizards. And then the lizards are like, oh, you want health care? Fill out this paperwork. Like, if they are lizards, that makes perfect fucking sense. If they're sentient humans who have compassion, it makes no sense, you know? So it's like, you know, lizard is just an analogy for just, like, ruthless capitalism.
Yeah, no.
You know? And just like how the student loan situation is here, where doctors lose their medical license when they can't pay their student loans, and it's like, okay, but as a society, we could use this person as a doctor, or as a society, we could say, go be homeless now.
Yeah,
it's like, how about we wipe their loans and say, hey, congrats on your medical degree.
Right now.
Go work in this hospital.
Well, the other thing is, do you know that, like, the places that need doctors most, the medical association, like the governing board that's in charge of dispatching doctors to rural areas, won't send doctors to the areas where people need them most, or even people... There's, like, MDs. There's another program besides MD in which you're a qualified doctor. But there's, like, weird politics that are involved that won't let let you be sent to certain areas.
Uh-huh.
And the financial incentives are so offset that even if your doctor is passionate about helping people,
right,
but you have to sacrifice so much in order to go work that they're like, it's almost not worth it. And then the amount of all these issues, because the chance of you getting sued for malpractice is so much higher, because if you're there on ground zero. And dude, there are all these issues. People outside the medical practice like have no idea what's going on, but yeah, there's so much fucked up situations going on.
Oh yeah. And like lawyers are just, you know, suing doctors who are trying to do treatments, and then the pharmaceutical companies set up an opioid crisis. Then the doctors who follow the pharmaceutical interest plans and are incentivized to do it are then thrown in jail for doing that when it's the pharmaceutical companies who set up this scenario. I mean, if it's like, oh, okay, lizards, then it's like, oh, okay, they're trying to kill us. Mm-hmm. They're trying to...
But it's almost like that Wonder Woman thing where, like, Wonder Woman kills... Do you watch Wonder Woman?
Not at all.
She's like, the point of that is, like, Ares is supposed to be responsible. Wonder Woman thinks Ares is responsible for all war. And she, like, kills Ares and people are still fighting. It's like, oh, what's going on? It's like, oh, no, it's just people. People are like that.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I think whenever I hear conspiracies, like, lizards are in charge, it's always like, oh, yeah, that would be great if that was true. But it's probably just us. Like, that's why I like anime so much. Because I can be like, oh, Titans are the reason humanity is retarded. But it's really just humans. It's really just humans being humans.
Going back to that thing of the list of, like, you know, me, my number one priority in life is comedy. Then mm-hmm. second is making money. And then third is comedy again. Mm-hmm. And then whatever. And then there are people who are like, number one is Netflix and this and that.
I don't understand those people. Like, there's some... I always feel... like a little distant.
Oh yeah.
Like I'm honestly kind of like fascinated by.
It's almost like you're living. They're living a daydream, or like they don't think that it's real.
No,
so they don't.
There are moments like where I'm like, I think that life is better than mine. I think that's a
maybe
happier, more fulfilling life.
Right.
And people are like, oh, those people are drones. Like those people get families. Like they go get entertained and they have this pretty cozy life set up for themselves. If you follow that track.
Yeah.
I just don't understand it, though.
Me too. I'm so driven to do comedy,
right,
that I don't know. Yeah, I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't...
That's so weird. Yeah. It's almost like a different... I always feel like a different species sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of them.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's so weird. Like, once you're a comic, you can only really talk to other comics.
Yeah, because, you know, I think that the goal of going... I mean, like, headlining Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco, getting $7,000 a weekend for telling jokes for an hour. That sounds like the seventh level of heaven to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, going to the Montreal Comedy Festival, I get a hotel paid for, my meals are paid for, mm-hmm. I'm getting paid, boom, I win this trophy, boom. I mean, that sounds like fucking heaven. It sounds amazing.
I mean, headlining comedy, a headliner, a professional, like, eighth-year headliner is probably, like, the best life available to a human easily.
Possible. The best life possible in... any country is being
Well, you get to travel the world.
Oh, yeah.
That's the most underrated. That's one of the things. You get to travel the whole world.
Yes.
And, like, not really work for an hour, but you get to, like, work for an
hour.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then go explore it.
I mean, I've also, like, hung out with Tom Rhodes a decent amount, and he's been on my podcast, and I've hung out with him at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. And, like, I tend to feel like if there was no gravity, he would be like a beam of light. Like... he's traveled the world multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
He's the nicest person ever to open micers and everybody who asks him a question. I mean, he's so fucking sweet. And it's like, you know, he just had a divorce, which is unfortunate. But, you know, his life is so fucking great that it's like, wow, man, that's exactly what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he's doing it perfect, you know?
No, yeah, that's That's so weird, by the way, that comedians get to have this isolated little thing and then get this enclave.
But then also, it's like a doctor. Like, let's say you're a surgeon. Like, you have to keep up with the current medical...
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's say there's a Da Vinci robot now that does heart attack surgeries. Now you have to learn how to, instead of doing the surgery, you have to learn how to work with this robot to do the surgery. Or, you know, you always have to kind of stay ahead on the cutting edge of things. And just like, that's true of a comic too. You know, if you're not reading the newspaper, if you're not paying attention to what's going on in politics in your country, or if you're not reading books, or if you're not, you know, being intellectually stimulated, or go see a play every now and then, or go on a hike that's dangerous, you know, if you're not doing things, like, you're gonna be stagnant too. You know, you need to live and love and be dumped and all this stuff to go talk about something interesting on stage. You know, you got to stay current, you know?
I think, yeah. I think also, like, it gets weird because comedians, I don't know, like, when my comedian friends, I'm so honest with them.
Yeah.
I'm so, like, I'm just myself that... If I ever lose one of them, if I have to, like, leave this world, I don't even imagine a world in which I'm not a comedian because I'm like, I have to interact with people and not talk about how I love hentai. That's so weird to me now.
Right. Because
I've gotten so accustomed to being so unfiltered. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but it seems alien to me, the idea that I would cover up part of myself.
Yeah.
To just interact
with
other humans.
You ever, like, curse around somebody and they're like, oh, don't say that. And you're like, what the
fuck? No, it's not gotten that bad.
Are you talking
But it's gotten to the point where, like, I'll talk
My mom tries to, like, I'll be in a restaurant, I'll be like, this fucking guy, she'll be like, I'll be like, shut the fuck up. I'll say fuck as many times as I want. You're my mom.
No, it's crazy.
I'm going to be honest with you, and we're not going to have a conversation right now.
No, that's,
You know what I mean? To the censors? What? I'm trying to be as honest as possible, and sometimes the fuck slips out. That's just what's happening.
I think I don't want to say conformity, but I think politeness is overvalued in our society to an extreme degree. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because you always go on the internet and you're like, why are people on the internet so confrontational? Mm. I think that's our natural self. I think we like human beings get in disagreements a lot and like being confrontational. Mm-hmm. Because of the way society is structured, we actually, it's very like a you try your best not to fuck around with other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you see, like, things of cops, like, shooting people, you're like, well, where does this come from?
Mm.
It's like, that's natural human instinct. It's like, when you get power, you're like, I'm going to shoot somebody. And it's
Did you feel like in high school in New Jersey, you were challenged in New Jersey? Like, people would fuck with you or they would be confrontational with you? Like, you know.
Oh, for what?
Bullying.
No. Not really. You know what it was? I lived in Singapore. I don't know if... I lived in Singapore before I moved to America, and I think that was, like, when I had the most, like, bullying experiences. Yeah. But I think, I don't want to be, like, overvalued, because it wasn't, like, bullying the way you see in documentaries, but I think it was bullying that was harmful enough, but also helpful enough, to which it probably aids me in the long term.
Oh, wow.
Because, there was, I want to make a bit about this, there's this Asian kid, because there are no black people in Singapore, not much at least. So there's an Asian kid who's...
So English is your second language?
No, English, people speak English in Singapore, that's everyone's first language. But I was born in India. But yeah, English, I learned English first. But they used to call me the N-word. Like, that's like the racial slur they use in Singapore. And I think that was, like, the most racism I've had to deal with. But in New Jersey, yeah, people wouldn't fuck with me that much until, like, senior year of high school. That was interesting that happened. I was really short, but people still wouldn't. It was almost interesting that I didn't get bullied, because I would see other kids get bullied, and I'd be like, that's weird that that's not happening to me.
Hmm.
But it was fun, yeah.
Did being bullied in Singapore make you want to be good at comedy to
like
defend
the
yourself?
Origins of comedy? No, the origins of comedy only happened senior year of high school, because what had happened was, I've spoken this by my friends, I was a very normal kid in a lot of ways. I was like normal deviant. You know how like there are people who are like, oh, that kid's weird, but they're like normal weird, right? And comedy is almost like extra. You know, they're like deviant to the deviants. I was, like, normal deviant up until the point of, like, what happens, like, I lost my high school presidential election. I was supposed to be president of my high school, but, like, this was weird. Some girl who was, like, a really artsy, like, quiet girl, like, won the election, and then a series of things happened to me socially where I was, like, oh, I feel ostracized now. Because I was used to actually being kind of, not, like, a popular kid, but I would hang out with, like, cool kids. I would go to parties and stuff, and then suddenly I didn't have that anymore, and I was like, what the fuck is this? And it was new to me.
Because you lost the election, and they were like, oh, this guy's a loser.
Well, it was also self-inflicted, because I became very depressed. I became, depressed for, like, a year. I was quite suicidal, so it was hard to be around me, honestly. I wouldn't blame them. But, yeah, I lost, like, all my social contacts one by one. And it was an interesting experience to be isolated that late. Because when you're a kid who gets bullied and stuff, that typically happens earlier in life, and then you sort of, like, become normal later on.
Mm.
For me, it was really late. It was like when I was 17 years old, dealing with social ostracization for like the first time, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what pushed me to do comedy, because like, fuck, welp.
You realize how powerful words are and how you could be like a master of social situations if you're good at comedy, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, it's literally, it's almost like a superpower.
It is a superpower.
But I can't hold it with people who aren't comedians for more than like 10 minutes. I get tired and I'm like, I gotta leave.
You don't know what I'm saying. I'm trying to tell you how it is to be me, and you have no idea what I'm talking
about. What do
you mean? No, look, when you talk to civilians who aren't comics,
they're
like, I'm trying to explain something to you. It's not gonna happen. We're too different, you know?
Oh, no, it's not even that. It's like, you're literally like, I'm tired. I'm tired of, Because you're so intellectually similar when you speak to other comics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're always talking about... You're talking about, like, you know, fucking jokes and shit and just stuff that happens in your life, but, it, like, 10 seconds later, you're talking about the philosophy of the universe, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're back to just talking about, oh, fuck, why wouldn't this booker book me or whatever? And that ping pong...
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't happen with people who aren't pursuing... Even with other artistic paths, I've noticed is with music and stuff is... People don't talk about shit like that. They don't. Mm. They don't engage in that type of behavior that often.
Mm.
I think that's very endemic to comedy. The fact that we're always in this realm of like speaking.
But then there's other kinds of flavors of performance arts. You know, like there's like
poetry.
Poetry slam people. I wonder if they are beefing all the time, or if they're like, you know, oh, their rhymes are hack or whatever. Like, I wonder if they're.
I think that happens. But the thing with the poetry community, I think with any community that isn't. Comedy is very easy. It's far. You can get wrapped up in delusion in any artistic profession, but what I've noticed with poetry is they're very sensitive, but they also have comedians are sensitive too. But comedians have to adopt high pain tolerance, just to bomb, go on the road, things
right,
like that.
Right, right.
Poets never have. Poets and musicians never have to have high pain tolerance because people aren't telling them that their poems suck. They're always supportive. Same
right,
with
right.
music when you go to an open mic. Even if you're bad or even if you're average, there's a huge tolerance for mediocrity in things that aren't comedy.
Because it's like they can always say, oh, well, you know, they just didn't get it.
And no, it's not even that. It's like because your friends would be like, oh, yeah, man, you were great, though. You write a different poem or whatever. Oh, you were great. You sounded so good. But in order to be a comic, you're constantly put up against greatness because you're like, you see headliners and you're like, that's so amazing.
Yeah.
I want to be like that.
Yeah.
People don't laugh. And they go, fuck you if you don't make them laugh because they feel entitled to laughter.
Right, right.
And so you have to deal with that constantly. And so whether you realize or not, you're always pushed to being getting better. I don't think that's as true with poetry or music or monologues or... Acting is so weird to me because you don't get to act unless you get cast and shit, which is an insane... Like, you don't get to do the thing unless someone else picks you to do the thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's so insane.
Yeah, yeah. Being an actor, I went to undergrad at Temple University for 1 year, and my major was acting. Mm-hmm. And then I switched to the New School and I went for creative writing. And because I just realized, like, I don't want to fucking act. I don't want to learn these lines and then go, like, try to... be this sad, goofy neighbor or whatever. I want to write my own stuff. I want to perform my own stuff. And I want to be accountable if it sucks.
Oh, the urge to make things.
Yeah, I think that's
it. I think that's what you're trying to get at the whole time. It's like, I don't understand people who don't have the urge to make things.
Right, right.
I, like, don't understand that.
I would act in a script that I wrote, though.
Uh-huh.
Like, if I write a screenplay...
I wouldn't even do that, probably.
And then I would write myself a cheeky little part and put myself in it because I would be saying jokes that are my favorite jokes to say because I wrote them and you know what I mean?
Right.
And I would give myself a choice character that got to be funny in the way I want to be funny. But I don't know. I'm not saying never. I'm not saying if, Martin Scorsese was like, hey, I got a new mob movie, fuck yeah, I'll do that. But, for the most part, probably not. Like, I don't see myself going to auditions ever.
No, yeah, that's ridiculous.
If someone offered me a part, that would be interesting. But I don't really want
to. Bobby Lee's talked about this. It's like, I don't want to go to auditions anymore. I'm like, because you get a lot of pride as a stand-up comic also when you know you're a murderer. You're like,
why
the fuck would I interact with
like,
you?
Like, you're getting paid, and then now you want to go to something that... Like, maybe it's just odds. If I go to a comedy show, there's 100% chance, like, at a certain level. If I go do this weekend, there's 100% chance I get paid. Mm-hmm. Then I come home. If you're going for an acting role, there could be 100 other people. So now there's a 1 in 100 chance that I'm going to get paid for driving and going down there.
Right. No, it's...
No, thanks. You know? Yeah, watch my special. If you like my shit, book me. If not, suck my fucking dick. I'm not coming down to your room to read your fucking stupid lines.
Yeah, no. It's, yeah, man.
You gotta know what to do with your day.
Don't you, like, hate other artists that aren't comedians?
Yes. Yes.
Don't you feel that?
I mean, dancers, I don't get what you're doing. I don't get what you're doing. You wanna dance in a troupe, or you want to like dance?
I have some more admiration for dancers, though.
I don't know, man. I'm just like, I would never. Would you ever buy a ticket to go watch people dance?
I've had to, but it's always been like a family member. It's always been
right,
like,
right. Yeah. But I'm saying, like, if it was your choice.
No. But I also don't buy tickets to go see the opera.
Oh my god, that sounds tall. I think musicals are the worst thing ever. I
mean, really?
Except for like Book of Mormon or something. Like, but it's like Oklahoma.
I enjoy musicals in general. I've always enjoyed musicals.
I just think like they don't move the plot fast enough.
Oh.
It'll be like
it's not about it's the plot's pretty stupid. It's always just the music and the.
I hate that, but it's like I'm a screenwriter, right? I want to see, you know, the Bourne supremacy movies where he's like, oh, this is a plot point, and now there's a gunfight, and now there's a dialogue, and I learn that. Oh my God, that's that person. And then they're shooting each other instead of like, Becky got a cake. She got a cake. It's 10 minutes on the same fucking thing.
Yeah, no, Becky got a cake.
I mean, what are you doing for 10 minutes?
I think you.
Then
gotta,
all these other dancers come out.
Gotta
what
appreciate.
The fuck? What's next?
Nothing. There's nothing.
Oh, I'm not that dumb where I could watch that. I'm not that dumb. I need more stimulation than Becky got a cake for 10 fucking minutes.
You know what?
I could never
though,
do that.
Is whatever. I think whatever thing you're good at, I think you're always attracted in terms of consumption to the art form that you don't have a natural competence in. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely like music. I have no ability in that whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I can't sing for shit. I can't act for shit. I can't do anything that isn't, yeah, it's crazy.
Pixar movies also blow my mind because I think about all the animation. The screenwriting's always perfect.
Yeah, that's insane. I can't even imagine animating anything.
Yeah.
There are these skills that are really, like, alien to me, and I have huge admiration for people who can do it. Like,
also,
dancers, yeah.
It's storytelling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It also, you know what trips me out? It's like South Park, you know, Trey Parker, Matt Stone. Like, they've never done stand-up, and that... And I think sometimes, and this kills me to say
Oh, you'd
say
be surprised,
it,
man. People are still afraid of stand-up, even in high levels in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
And I think Trey Parker could have been one of the best ever.
Really?
Based on South Park. But also, I feel, and this pains me to say, South Park is inconsistent.
Oh, no,
sometimes you watch a great episode, and then two episodes later, they're not funny.
Aren't the episodes almost good? I like the bad episodes a lot,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if Trey Parker did stand-up, if he cross-trained, that's what I'm saying. If you're a screenwriter and a stand-up, you're a dangerous, dangerous person.
Right.
If you're just a stand-up, like, yeah, you have blind spots. Now you're getting called from Perth Amboy.
This is probably, I'll figure it out later.
Yeah, we're almost done. We're gonna walk over to the Stress Factory. But Akash Anand, do you have a Facebook? Do you have an Instagram? How can people find you?
I got an Instagram. It's ITS Akash Anand, and then Facebook is Akash Anand. Yeah.
Well, nice. I like getting you early because I see like, oh wow, I think in 10 years you're gonna be a bad motherfucker headlining and all that stuff.
Appreciate it, man.
But I just see your enthusiasm. I see your love of the game. And that's why I wanted to talk to you and have you on my podcast.
It's been great talking to you, man. It was a great first podcast experience. I got to do it with you.
Thank you very much. That's been another episode of Highway Motherfucking Diary in the Bag with my guest, Akash Anand.
Peace out, guys.
Later.
Bye.